From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov Wednesday highlighted the need to decide which of the various opposition groups fighting in Syria should be part of future peace talks and which should be considered terrorists. Lavrov spoke at a press conference after meeting in Moscow with UN envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura. De Mistura said it was important to work on the formation of an inclusive government in Syria.
The regional players and the international community can help in reminding both sides, the government and the opposition, to come quickly for starting discussing without preconditions on either side in order to actually address the points which were agreed upon at the Vienna meeting, which are and should be in line with the Geneva communique. Basically, we have already the papers ready for them to start talking. They need to do what we saw in Vienna. They need to start talking. And the UN is ready for it.
Again, that is the UN envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura. At least 10 people were killed and up to 150 trapped on Wednesday when a factory collapsed near Pakistan's eastern city of Lahore, according to officials. Rescue workers digging for survivors with construction equipment had recovered 35 people so far. The factory is located about 25 kilometers south of the city. It's not clear what caused the collapse, though construction work had been going on there. A plane has crashed in South Sudan shortly after taking off from the busy Juba airport, killing at least 32 people. Officials say one survivor, a young child, was found. Reports say the cargo plane crashed just 800 meters short of the runway Wednesday, landing in woodland along the shore of the White Nile River. VOA News. The Islamic State is renewing its claim to have brought down the Russian jetliner that crashed in the Sinai Peninsula, challenging skeptics to prove otherwise. In an audio statement posted Wednesday on social media sites, the Islamic State said it would disclose details of the attack when it decides to. Authorities say they have not found any evidence of a missile attack at the time that the metro jet crashed Saturday, killing all 224 people aboard. Meanwhile, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has defended the raft of repressive security laws pushed through by his government on the eve of talks in London with British Prime Minister David Cameron. This is a real roadmap for democracy in Egypt. Sisi made the comment to BBC television ahead of his visit. He said the Egyptian people have been calling for change for years, and it's our utmost wish to meet their demands. The UN Children's Fund sees no sign that migrant flows into Europe are slowing down. UNICEF says the number of refugees making the journey across the Mediterranean Sea is increasing. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UNICEF Refugee and Migrant Crisis Chief in Europe, Marie-Pierre Poirier, has just returned from a week-long mission tracking the migrants as they move from the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia at the border with Greece to Serbia and Croatia. She says people along the route told her they were risking their lives because the prices had gone down.
It looked like smugglers, because of rough weather and possible more difficulties, are giving a discount to anybody.
Prices reportedly have gone down from a high of $5,000 to a little over $1,000 for a family. As a consequence of these bargain rates, the migrant flows into Europe appear to be unstoppable, at least for now. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thousands of Iranians burned the American flag and chanted slogans Wednesday as they marked the anniversary of the seizure of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran by militant students 36 years ago. The annual state-organized rally drew greater attention this year as Iranian hardliners looked to counter moderate President Hassan Rouhani's outreach to the West following a landmark nuclear deal reached with world powers in July. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan vows to press ahead with the military campaign against Kurdish militants after his ruling party swept to victory early this week in parliamentary elections. Erdogan said Wednesday that Turkey will continue its fight until every militant from the outlawed Kurdistan Workers Party is defeated. The U.S. trade deficit declined in September to the lowest level in 7 months. It comes as exports rebounded while imports shrank, reflecting the smallest monthly foreign oil bill in more than a decade. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an analyst speaks with us about Russia's policy on Iran. Our correspondent shares what she's found in dangerous Nangarhar, Afghanistan. We'll talk with Chef about the love of chocolate chip cookies.
Who can resist the combination of sugar and butter and chocolate and flour all mixed together?
Makes me hungry. And we'll hear about a musical based on the lives and music of Gloria and Emilio Estefan. It's right here on The Voice of America.
A Russian foreign ministry spokeswoman said Tuesday Moscow does not consider it a matter of principle that embattled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad must stay in power, adding that it's up to the Syrian people. My colleague Victor Beatty is following the story and joins us now here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, Maria Sakharova told a Moscow radio audience yesterday the Kremlin never said Mr. Assad has to go or stay. She warned that regime change could turn into a catastrophe for the region in an effort to end nearly 5 years of conflict. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said he's dubious this represents a change in Russian policy, adding that Moscow's military and political strategy remain at odds with each other.
I have doubts that it reflects any sort of change in their view. And unfortunately, it's certainly inconclusive about whether or not they're prepared to change their flawed strategy. The fact is the Russians acknowledged the need for a political transition. This is something that President Putin and President Obama had the opportunity to discuss in New York a little over a month ago. President Putin, in the context of that meeting, affirmed for the president his commitment to the need for a political transition inside of Syria. The problem has been that he's engaged in a military strategy that undermines that political objective. Right now, the Russian regime is carrying out military attacks against the very people that should be participating in a political dialogue to try to effect a political transition inside of Syria.
Meanwhile, U.S. State Department spokeswoman Elizabeth Trudeau said Tuesday that while the diplomatic situation is more promising than it has been, the international community must first reach consensus on the path forward in Syria. Alam Payen, director of the Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University, told me he sees a policy shift which may put Russia and ally Iran at odds over the fate of Mr. Assad.
At the beginning, they wanted to support Bashar al-Assad to stay in power. But finally, after these 4 years, they have learned that it's a difficult task. And if Bashar al-Assad stays in power and Iran supports that and interferes in the affairs of Syria, Russia would probably antagonize the Sunni world in the Middle East and also outside the Middle East. So it would be similar to what when the Soviet Union came to Afghanistan and, as a matter of fact, antagonized the Shiites and the Sunnis and everyone against the Soviet Union. So now Russia is learning from that lesson. They thought probably this would be an easy solution at the beginning. They started bombarding the positions of the opposition to Bashar al-Assad, and that did not prove much results either. And we learned that one of the Russian officers died in Syria, and there were conflicting reports. According to the Russians, he committed suicide. But the parents of the same person, the Russians, said that, no, he was not suicidal. So who knows? And now this plane has also crashed in Sinai. So these are the beginning, and I think Russians know that that it's not an easy task. If Bashar al-Assad stays, it creates different sorts of problems. And if he does not leave the country and does not pave the way for a transition, that's where we see this divergence between the position of Russia and Iran.
The White House said on Monday they discounted the Russian comments, saying they had doubts that it reflects any sort of change. But are you suggesting that Russia may be coming around to the U.S. view on Syria?
No, they're not coming to the U.S. view, but they just want to make a sort of transition. Maybe they will come to the position which the Iranians have suggested in Vienna, that there should be some sort of a transitional period, and then there will be a new election in Syria, and Bashar al-Assad may be one of the people that would contest the elections in Syria. I just learned from what Major General Muhammad Ali Jafari, who is the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, he said that, well, the Russian position is different than our position. Maybe Moscow is not that much interested in Bashar al-Assad to stay, which is different, but we want Bashar al-Assad to stay. So this is what we think, that now there is a sort of friction coming between the Iranian position and the Russian position.
Alam Payen says Russia knows that its bombing campaign, which is causing growing civilian casualties among the Syrian population, could fuel growing anti-Russian animosity in the Arab world, and that adds urgency to finding a political solution.
Thank you very much, Victor.
All right, Susan.
On social media concerning what is going on in Syria, Stephen R. Hurst with the Associated Press writes in an analysis piece, "There's much speculation about Russian motives for intervening in Syria. The root answer lies in the timing. Vladimir Putin, the Kremlin boss, finally decided Syrian leader and Moscow ally Bashar al-Assad was in danger of losing control of Damascus, the capital of the civil war-ravaged nation. That, in turn, would have crushed a key Russian foreign policy objective, keeping Syria together as a unitary state and maintaining the Russian foothold in the Middle East." The Christian Science Monitor notes, President Obama's decision to send up to 50 special operations forces to northern Syria to work with Kurdish and Arab opposition groups in their four-year-old bid to oust the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is essentially a political statement. Above all, the deployment tells the Russians, who have solidified their place in the international efforts to resolve the Syrian conflict after 5 weeks of pro-Assad airstrikes, that the U.S. now has skin in the game and thus is that much more determined to influence the steps ahead in Syria. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Planetary scientist Shoshana Cole from Ithaca College says she has found evidence that some type of acid fog created by past volcanic activity dissolved rocks on Mars. Acid fog, or VOG as it's known on Earth, is created when volcanic gas reacts with oxygen and sunlight, a process visible at Hawaii's Kilauea volcano. Cole used a variety of data gathered by NASA's Spirit rover in the Husband Hills area of Mars' Gusev crater to make her findings. The data allowed her to hypothesize that the rocks were exposed to acidic rain vapor from volcanic eruptions over a long period of time. She says that after the Martian VOG settled on the rocks, it dissolved some of its minerals and then formed a gel. Later, after the gel's water evaporated, it left behind material that broke down the rocks. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA journalists have ventured into Afghanistan's Nangarhar province, an area where the Islamic State is gaining ground. South Asia correspondent Aisha Tanzim is now in Kabul, and she joins us on the line. Welcome, Aisha.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. What did you find in Nangarhar?
What we did was we went out all the way to a district of Nangarhar called Achin District, which has become literally the hub of Daesh or the Islamic State group in Afghanistan, especially in eastern Nangarhar. And what we found was that, A, they have been able to establish a safe haven there. There is an area where the local security forces do not go because it's too dangerous for them. They're trying to galvanize the local population, but the local population is very scared, and they want the government to launch a full-scale military operation before they will either go back or have any kind of resistance against this group. So that was one finding. The other thing that we found was that these people who claim to be militants of the Islamic State group arrived in eastern Nangarhar first as they called themselves refugees, and they said that they were running away from the military operation that neighboring Pakistan is carrying out in North Waziristan. And initially they arrived with their families, with women and children and all of their belongings, and they asked local residents for shelter. And locals, because it's the local tribal tradition, they gave them a place in their homes, let them stay in their guest houses. And within a month or 2 months, as the number of these people, these foreigners, grew, they started displaying weapons and show of force, and eventually they pulled out the black flags and declared themselves to be the Daesh, the Khilafat-e-Khurasan, which is what the Islamic State group calls this region, which includes Pakistan, Afghanistan, and some Central Asian states. They also asked the locals to pledge allegiance to them, what they call Baith or Baya. What we also found, which was very interesting, was that they have money. They were offering locals up to $500 and $600 more for higher commanders as pay per month. That's a lot of money for Afghanistan. That's almost double than what the National Army is paying their soldiers. So They have money. We are trying to track down the funding sources. But it seems like, and they're fighting with Taliban in the region. They have pushed Taliban out of, like, some districts, some areas. The Taliban are also fighting to regain control. So it's quite a mess here. That's what we found.
On a personal level, what about your own safety and that of your cameraman?
Well, we had to go through a lot of planning, days of planning, just to make this one trip. It was a very dangerous area. Even local journalists don't go there. We had to disguise ourselves as locals. I was in totally local clothing. I was wearing a long gown, what they call an abaya. I had that. I had another long gown that they wear, women wear, local women, when they're out. It's called a burqa. I had a security scanner on. We had to, inside Achin, have security. So we had, for that part, got help from the army and the local district governor. And we were in armored Humvees because we were going over areas that very recently had seen IED explosions and cars had blown up. We had to be in a bulletproof vest when we went out to the front lines because sniper fire had taken out several soldiers on that check post. So that part, then we were passing through bazaars where drivers were saying that militants sometimes throw grenades at moving cars. You don't even have to stop there. So we had to think about all of those threats and mitigate. And then we were worried about somebody noticing us and following us back. So we were constantly looking in the rearview mirror to make sure, you know, nobody was following us. There was a lot of planning. It was very tense. I did not really breathe until we were out of Nangarhar and back on our way to Kabul.
Well, we're very glad that you've gotten back there safely.
Well, thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, chef says chocolate chip cookies were first an American delicacy. And On Your Feet, we'll have Yours Tapping. Chocolate chip cookies, who can resist them? Mom would make them for me as an after-school treat. Real estate agents whip them up to give a place for sale that homey smell. Kids put them out for Santa on Christmas Eve. Whether hot out of the oven or out of a store-bought bag, folks love chocolate chip cookies. But why? Well, joining us online to answer that question is Frances Nelson Beebe, chef and owner of Mr. Nelson's Cookies in Gold Canyon, Arizona. Welcome, chef.
Thank you, Susan. I'm pleased to be here and chatting with you and your listening audience.
Oh, thank you so much. So tell us, why is the chocolate chip so beloved?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I think you hit on an excellent point as you were chatting. I think there's two reasons. One's the physiological reason, and then there's a psychological reason. And physiologically, I would say, you know, who can resist the combination of sugar and butter and chocolate and flour all mixed together? It just seems to fit the American taste bud. But beyond that is what you just chatted, and I think there's a deep psychological reason, because American chocolate chip cookies are an American phenomena. We own it uniquely, and we can chat that in just a second. But I think it brings up all the images of childhood. I think all the wonderful things that wherever you were, whatever your mom was, a good cook, a bad cook, whether your grandma did it, it has all these images of almost like the Vaseline on the lens, where you just everything that you thought about childhood that was wonderful included a chocolate chip cookie treat. So you had something that, one, tasted wonderful to our taste buds, but beyond that, it conjured up all these wonderful things about coming home and having milk and cookies waiting for you. And more times than not, it was a chocolate chip cookie because of the simplicity of the recipe. And many times, you know, I've had people say, "Geez, is there anybody that doesn't like a chocolate chip cookie?" And so here's some statistics for you: 90% of the on a survey that was taken, of all people actually like cookies, And of that, 60 to 65%, their number one cookie is chocolate chip.
So why do you say it's an American thing?
Well, actually, it was actually created in the 1930s, and it depends who you listen to, but it was actually created in the 1930s by a woman by the name of Ruth Wakefield. And she had a very popular restaurant in Massachusetts called the Toll House restaurant. And she typically made a butter cookie, I believe, and she just wanted something different. So she said, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to add pieces of chocolate. There was no such thing as the iconic teardrop flat bottom chip that we're used to that we see in on Nestle's bag today and people grew up with. And she actually added the chocolate, believing it was going to melt into the cookie. And as fate would have it, it didn't melt. So as a result, you had chips, pieces of chocolate that were in this cookie. And it became an instant hit with her patrons. And it was not unnoticed when she actually, again, it was a very successful restaurant. And when she published one of her cookbooks called The Toll House Tried and True Recipes, she actually included a recipe called the Toll House Chocolate Crunch Cookie. It didn't gonna go unnoticed by the chocolate makers of America, notably Hershey. And they reached out to her and they said, Ruth, we think you have something here. And of course, they're selling chocolate, and geez, their opportunity for increased sales just exploded with the thoughts of this. And they said, I'll tell you what, we'll give you a lifetime of chocolate if you'll sell us the recipe. And she did.
Thank you, Chef Beebe. We appreciate you speaking with us. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Dementia affects many millions of mostly older people. The disease can be overwhelming to patients and caregivers. But in Australia, patients in facilities around Tasmania are getting visits from some new four-legged friends, courtesy of Delta Therapy Dogs.
It's very relaxing. They mellow. They start chatting. They talk to the dog very often first, and then they'll talk to us. The dog's obviously more important.
Care coordinator Dave Dunkerley says that therapy dogs have a calming effect on dementia patients.
Particularly with dementia, you can get some undesirable behaviours at times, and of course they can't help it, but the dogs tend to lessen the behaviours.
According to the World Health Organization, there are about 47 million people worldwide living with dementia, a number that's expected to double in 20 years. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
A musical based on the lives and music of Gloria and Emilio Estefan is called On Your Feet. It looks at the groundbreaking Grammy-winning couple who gave the world hits such as Conga, 1-2-3, and Get On Your Feet. International Edition's David Byrd reports.
Ana Villafañe is a lifelong fan of Gloria Estefan. She even attended the same Miami, Florida high school as the seven-time Grammy-winning singer, Our Lady of Lourdes Academy. Now she gets to work with and to portray the star in the new musical, On Your Feet. Villafañe learned of a Miami open casting call last year, but was not able to attend. She sent the casting office a video audition, and within 3 days was called to audition for the Estefans and Tony-winning director Jerry Mitchell. Ana says that the role, her Broadway debut, is not only the fulfillment of a dream, but also a big responsibility.
I mean, to be chosen to play this part and to step into these shoes, it's a huge deal, because she's not just who she is, and it's not because she's a star, and it's not because she's such a diva, which she rightfully is. It's more because I think of the person that she is and what she represents to so many people, to not just the Latin community, I think on the world stage, because she broke a lot of barriers in being herself and in being herself without being a stereotype and without being cliche.
The musical also stars Josh Segarra as Emilio Estefan. Segarra says that he has seen the cultural barriers shift in theater, where Latin actors and actresses are not defined by their ethnicity and don't have to fit into stereotypical roles.
We now get to play characters that happen to be Latino. Mm-hmm. They happen to be Cuban and happen to be El Salvadorian and happen to be Puerto Rican. And it's not defining us anymore. So to get to play a man that has broken walls, that's broken barriers, that's an honor. You know, I get to kind of live through that a little bit. I get to say some pretty important stuff in this show. We get to share some pretty important moments in this show, and we get to live it every night. So as an artist, you can only grow from that.
Ana Villafañe says the play shows some of the struggles the Estefans went through to stay true to their identity and to their vision.
You know, she tells me stories all the time about when she would get somewhere and, you know, certain concert venues would be like, oh, we want to put, like, you know, fruits on your head and, like, you know, red lipstick and this and that and just the what you would stereotypically think. And she would say, no, I'm going out in leather and I'm going out in chaps and she didn't have to be any certain mold. She created one.
On Your Feet features choreography by four-time Drama Desk Award nominee and Olivier Award winner Sergio Trujillo. The book is by Academy Award winner Alexander Dinilaris. The score includes original orchestrations by Gloria and Emilio Estefan, and several members of the original Miami Sound Machine are in the orchestra. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
To invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What drives people, especially young men and women, to join brutal and exploitative terrorist groups like ISIL or Boko Haram? We must better understand these drivers if we are to counteract the ability of terrorists to recruit new members and prevent the formation of similar groups in the future. Individuals, even entire communities, may align with violent extremist groups for many complex reasons. Those who feel marginalized by society on the basis of politics, religious convictions, social or economic status, or other grievances may find terrorist propaganda persuasive and look to find meaning and acceptance within terrorist groups, which often provide a storyline that allows them to turn violence and inflict it on the society that had not fully accepted them. On a higher level, individuals and communities may seek meaning in radical ideologies and those who espouse them that seem to meet their needs for a purpose or identity. This means that in order to blunt the appeal of violent terrorist groups, we must find ways to fill unmet human needs. These can range from providing security to expanding economic options to giving marginalized communities a greater stake in determining their political future, said Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights Sarah Sewell. So we are increasing our work toward an approach to countering violent extremism that better prevents individuals and communities from wanting to align with terrorism in the first place. This includes building trust. It includes empowering a broader range of people, including civil society, businesses, religious leaders, women, youth, international bodies, and former violent extremists to counter the false promises of groups such as ISIL and build more resilient communities. And it involves building a network of global partners, including regional and multilateral institutions such as the Arab League, United Nations, World Bank, African Union, and World Economic Forum, to reinforce the civilian-led components of this approach. In short, if we can remove or lessen the most insistent factors that motivate people to turn toward violence, then we can start replacing destructive ideas that uphold terrorism as a means of change with an avenue toward individual and community improvement and hope for a better future.
As President Barack Obama said, ideologies are not defeated with guns. They're defeated by better ideas, a more attractive and compelling vision.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Heart, heart.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move, don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink. We engage you, the listener, and interact on a different topic each week. We've got loads of good tunes, lovely music, and lots of analysis to keep you going.
And interviews from experts or you telling us what you think about our daily topic. Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Statistics show that in the last two decades, the cost of higher education in Africa has increased by over 90%. In many countries, it has risen to the levels where students can't afford to pay their way through college, many dropping out of high school or giving up midway through their university education. In the past, many countries offered students with high grades some kind of merit scholarship based on the student's academic achievement. However, that has also changed, and in many public universities, the safety net of having government meet part of your tuition is really over. But that is besides the major complaint of many parents across Africa who lament that whereas their salaries have stagnated in the past decade, the price of education has skyrocketed. Many complain that they have had to deplete their savings or in some cases had to skip buying basic necessities for their families so they can pay university tuition for a child. There's no doubt that sustainable growth in Africa is contingent upon providing the right education to a critical mass of young people. These are the same people that go on to transform their economies, their country's economies. Therefore, the goal of any government should be to provide its youth with an affordable, good quality, and relevant higher education. In South Africa, the recent mass student protests over tuition hikes highlighted a problem that is not limited to their system alone. And even though most governments will claim that public funding is already overstretched, there is a need to refocus priorities to meet the growing demand for access to higher education. Obviously, the subsequent debate to this access, which we've had on the show right here on Upfront, is how to provide quality education that gives students the right skills to solve local issues while being able to compete on the global marketplace. So what's your take on this? Do you feel that your access to education is hampered by the high tuition rates? Stay tuned. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. But first, let's listen to your opinions.
Look at the cost that we get this education at. It is very alarming. For example, me as a student, the amount of money we pay is always very high, and the parents are always complaining about the tuition because it's too expensive and high for them, and you know it's not good for me because first of all, the books we need at university are very expensive themselves. We get these we have to buy them by our own selves, and this means that on top of the tuition which we pay, which is very high, we are buying textbooks. Now this is a very burden on my parent.
Education is expensive because as of now, people are paying a lot of money. For example, in some of the secondary schools, they are saying that this coming January, the fees will raise and will come in 12,000. So the people, they cannot afford to pay such kind of money.
For instance, last year, examination fee we were paying 2,700, but now it has been raised to 6,000, which is just showing that education is now expensive.
Very soon, all the problems of your nation
revolution. Young people revolution. Intelligent revolution. Must be African education.
Come back. If you've just joined us, this is Upfront of the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, D.C. Nadia Sami is in Johannesburg, South Africa, where thousands of students have been protesting the high costs of education. Our reporter Anita Powell is based in South Africa, in Johannesburg, South Africa, and she covered the Fees Must Fall protest and filed this report.
South African students won a major victory. After more than a week of protests against university tuition hikes, shut down at least 15 schools and earned the students a meeting with the president. Here's President Jacob Zuma at the conclusion of that meeting at the presidency with student leaders and academics.
We agreed that there will be a zero increase of university fees in 2016. Discussions will continue looking at broader issues than the fees.
Those issues, he said, include the idea of free education and the thorny race issues that underpin many discussions on education in South Africa. But that meeting was not without turmoil. As leaders talked behind closed doors in Pretoria, police outside fired stun grenades and used water cannon after some student protesters tried to force their way onto the premises. That echoed violent scenes from earlier in the week, as police scuffled with students in Cape Town and arrested 29 of them during a march on the nation's parliament. That kind of scenario is exactly what University of Johannesburg graduate Peter Lekalakala fears. The engineering graduate says he supports the move for free education, but worries that all sides in the fight will dig into their positions. South Africa's government says it simply can't afford to support all students. Universities say they are struggling to keep up with higher demand and rising costs without raising tuition. And student groups have said they will not halt protests until all their demands are met.
Obviously, it's going to lead to that point where they're going to corner someone and someone's going to have to fight back. And I think in this case, it's going to get violent. And unfortunately, the students have numbers, but they don't have the firepower to do it, whereas the police do.
Students on the streets of Johannesburg were quick to point out that much more needs to be done to make the university system fair to everyone. University of Johannesburg student Katleho Nduli says her family is middle class. But Nduli, whose first name means success, says she is struggling financially because her family is deemed too wealthy for her to get school loans and scholarships.
The government claims that my parents have enough money for me not to be able to be granted a bursary. But then still, you get to find out that they're also too poor for me to afford university.
This movement is about much more than just university fees. Today's college students belong to a generation known as Born Frees, South Africans born after the end of apartheid in 1994. But many of them say they're fed up with hearing promises from the government about equality and opportunity for all. Today, at least, their protests forced the government to put its words into action. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Now, Nadia, South Africa is considered to have one of the best education systems in Africa. But it seems that, according to these protesters, that the costs of education keep rising, making the education, this education, inaccessible to the majority of them.
You know, many families cannot even consider sending their kids to a university or a technicon because they simply cannot afford it. It's a luxury they cannot afford. And I say it's a luxury they cannot afford, but, you know, our constitution says it's a right. What we're seeing now is young people fighting for that right, fighting to make that possible for them and for generations to come, really. You know.
Now, did the protesters catch the government off guard? Was this a situation that government leaders had been unaware of?
While the government says it's your right to have an education, on the flip side, over the years, government has cut funding to tertiary education facilities. And that has been a major bone of contention among academics and among students and parents alike. So one could say this has been a disaster waiting to happen. It's not something that the government can say has taken it by surprise. This is something that young people have been warning for the past few years. They want attention to be given to this matter.
Now, for this current protest, what would you say was the trigger?
The current series of events started nearly 2 weeks ago. It all began at Wits University, which is one of South Africa's best and most celebrated institutions. Students rallied under the hashtag fees must fall. Initially, what they were calling for was the scrapping of fee hikes because there were announcements that the fees for the coming year, 2016, were quite large, and many students, who are battling to already pay off fees for perhaps their first and second years were now faced with, more increases. A lot of students have not been able to write their exams because they were told, well, you need to first cover your fees for last year. And many students just simply cannot afford it. This is South Africa, where there's a huge disparity in wealth. We don't have an equal distribution of wealth in any sense. We've got a very big divide between the country's wealthiest and the country's poorest. And so the announcement of fee hikes, just set the cat among the pigeons, and people, a lot of young people had said they had enough. Eventually, we had the finance minister holding a meeting with the various vice chancellors and student bodies, and he eventually made an announcement. Higher Education Minister Bladen Zimandi said that tuition fees at all institutions across the country would be capped at 6%. The students were not happy with this. They said 6% is still too high, it's still prohibitive, and the protests continued and gathered steam. What we saw was a massive protest, major turnout from UCT students, Cape Peninsula University of Technology students, marched to Parliament in Cape Town, where the finance minister was delivering his midterm budget speech. The intention there was for them to disrupt that speech. And they did storm the front section of Parliament, trying to get into the precinct. They weren't successful in getting in, but they were successful in having their message heard across the country and far beyond our borders. We saw a major outpouring of support on Twitter and other social media for the students. So this quickly gathered momentum, Jackson.
Go to school, my brother. I said, go to school. You will understand very soon all the problems of your nation. We want a revolution. Young people, revolution. Intelligent revolution must be African education.
So I would say that education has become more expensive over time, and I think there's no end to this spiral in costs. The costs are rising because, you see, the schools have to pay teachers. Issue is the government needs to recognize education has collapsed in this country.
Yeah, I considered education to be more expensive than whatsoever. In those days, government take responsibility or shoulder responsibility of people education and so on. But now that is not there on ground. So if the cost of education is rising or is going up and the poverty level still remain at this level, you will discover that a lot of our youth will remain at home, on school and whatsoever. To make it affordable to everybody, government should continue to probably fund our school and sustain our school and ensure that at least everybody is given a right. It's not even a chance. Everybody is given a right to go to school.
Thanks so much for your topics, guys. We love to hear from you, and do send us some suggestions if you have shows that you'd like us to follow up in the future. We love to hear from you. Now, Jackson, there's empirical evidence that education and economic development are directly related, and we've seen countries that invest in the education of its young people of its elderly people as well, experiences more positive social political changes.
True, true, Nadia. However, we've seen that for the past decade, education costs have increased exponentially. This has made it harder for people to afford basic and higher education.
So we've all been following the student protests in South Africa. Students are protesting the hikes in their tuition. Protests were mostly peaceful. We saw a couple of situations where they had confrontations with the police. But overall, they were peaceful. And I spoke to Zikisa Makubela, one of the leaders of the protests. He's the president of the Students' Representative Council at Rhodes University in South Africa. And he says that the Fees Must Fall protest was mainly to hold the ANC, the ruling party in power right now, on its promise to provide free education.
The citizens of the country holding the government accountable to the promises of the government, that they promise us free education. And so therefore we want free education. Having to pay 100,000 rand per year for rent tuition is a lot of money. Especially in a country riddled with unemployment and high poverty and high inequality. It's just very expensive.
You have a conversation previously before this current protest that we saw. Did you have conversations in the previous years with the government or policymakers around the issue of restructuring tuition?
Okay, so when it comes to government, there was an inquiry about three years ago into looking into the possibility and the feasibility of free education. That inquiry did its work and completed its work, but however, the Minister of Higher Education then refused basically to release a report from that inquiry proving and arguing that free education was possible and indeed was feasible. So that's basically that's where the conversation sort of died off.
There's basically a report saying that the South African government can afford to pay tuition for college-going students, or at least subsidize their tuition.
Yes.
But they did not release it.
That's what we have been told the report states. But the department has refused to release the report.
So the government refused to release the report that they commissioned. And how has the response been so far? Do you feel that the protest that you had, I know that you guys went to the parliament to demand answers. How do you feel the response has been from the government side towards towards your demands?
I think from the Minister of Higher Education in particular, his response has been overwhelmingly disappointing. We're actually quite appalled at his conduct around this entire issue, even going as far as making a joke about how if students refuse to go back to class, then they will start their own movement called Students Must Fall. And then laughing at that, despite the fact that the students are protesting because it's just genuinely too expensive to go to higher education.
So obviously that's not a very good response. That's not the kind of response students were looking for. If the Minister of Education can make those kind of proclamations, it feels like they didn't get the message then.
Basically, it's not the response you would expect from a ministry. It's not that type of response. And it was overwhelmingly disappointing. But I must commend the president who then decided to call a meeting with student leaders in a bid to address this. And when this meeting was called, it's with the vice chancellors of the two universities, the chairs of university councils, and SRC presidents across the country. And so once upon that meeting is where the no fee increase was approved for next year. And so I must commend the president of the country for in this instance playing a leading role in trying to address the issue. However, I'm disappointed in his Minister of Higher Education. And besides, this is something I think is true across the country. But I think the one thing that must be noted is that is not the end unto itself. What we want to achieve fundamentally is that the government must do as it has promised to do and give the country free education. And that's fundamentally what the students want. And this is almost an interim measure to the long-term conversation.
Okay, so the tuition hikes have been frozen right now, but did they say how long it will stay before they can increase them? Is there a time period?
Okay, so the fees was confirmed for this year only, and then the next thing that was established is that there's a tough team that is looking into issues of funding in higher education. and seeing how our funding can be improved and how issues of and fees and stuff can be improved. And now we're awaiting the results of that task team, and then we'll use that as the basis for moving forward. But currently the 0% is only specifically for 2016.
Is there a standard rate for education for this tuition? Just to give us an understanding of how expensive education is in South Africa, based on, say, I guess the average income of a household that has a child that goes to the university. Can you give us a little bit of an understanding of these kind of figures or disparities?
A couple of issues is that even when you would read a number like the GDP per capita, that number doesn't tell you much about what's happening with people's lives, because there's also very high inequality, right? And compounding to the issue of the GDP, right? And so we're looking at now that high inequality, low GDP. I mean, not necessarily low, it's an average of so GDP, but high inequality and high poverty, right?
Mm.
So you're looking at about 25.5% unemployment. And so the question is that where do you expect that bulk of the country? And also the 25.5% is a narrow definition of unemployment, right?
Kisa is the president of the Rhodes University Students Representative Council. We are talking about the protests in South Africa. There were thousands of college students in South Africa protesting the raise in their tuition, many saying that it's unaffordable and that education should be free or at least subsidized.
Education is not becoming more affordable in the sense that it is becoming very expensive. And so it's not everybody can afford education for their kids. And so I cannot say that, in my opinion, that education is becoming more affordable. The costs are rising because globally the cost of everything is going up, not just education. So if you talk of feeding, clothing, transportation, everything is going up, and as such, the teachers need to be paid well. The government need to budget, and they put high budget on education, and that increases everything, which will be transferred down to parents who pay school fees to maintain their kids in school, and that goes a long way to increase school fees, maintenance of the kids, taking them to school, bringing them back, or even keeping them in boarding schools. They are all increasing the cost of education.
Instead of you having a good education, they tell you good things cost money. And we begin to discover that with the way things are going on now, you may go to an expensive school and yet you don't get what you are looking for.
Those were some of your opinions on our topic. Let's listen to a conversation that I had with Emmanuel John, a medical student at Port Harcourt University.
The official policy by the government is that tuition is free in Nigerian universities. Okay. But we pay a huge sum for other sundry charges.
Or for other charges that are also education related.
Yes, yes.
Like textbooks and other things.
Not just books. They tell us to pay. They charge us for stuff like library fee, laboratory fees, identity cards, sports fees. You know, just as a way of circumventing the government's policy of no tuition payment in Nigerian universities. But it really is not working, because we end up paying so much, actually.
Have you seen costs rising in the past couple of years?
Yes, there's been a steady increase. When I got into school at the university where I school, the fees we paid were about 5,000 naira. And as I speak to you, we pay close to 30,000 naira. And some people pay as much as 40,000 naira. And then in some other universities, the cost is even much higher. And it's worse in the private universities, because those are purely commercial enterprises.
So this is a government university that we're talking about. This is a state-run university, state-run educational institution. So what happens if you're a student from a family that is not able to pay all these fees? What do you do? What happens to you? Do you abscond from your education?
Unfortunately, we've had cases where a lot of students had to drop out of schools because they were not able to afford fees. In fact, as I speak to you now, there are so many contradictions in our educational payment models. If you pay your school fees later than the time when you've been asked to pay, and then there's a 50% surcharge on late payment of school fees. That we've been trying to battle with as student activists. We've called the authorities to the fact that if you cannot afford to pay school fees at when due, then you can't afford to pay it when there's an extra 50% surcharge on it. I don't know who gave them the wisdom for that policy, but it happens in my school and a few other universities Nigeria. And what we hear is the government is planning to officially hike school fees in state-owned universities, state-run higher institutions. And it's a crisis, I hope, does not come up, because if it does come up, it's going to be a big problem.
That was Emmanuel John, a student at Port Harcourt University in Nigeria. Up front on the Voice of America, we're still exploring the issue of high tuition rates in African universities, specifically in South Africa, in light of what has been happening in South Africa with the Fees Must Fall protest movement. We've heard from students about these tuition hikes. Let's hear from a school administrator, somebody who actually works in a university, who is part of the school administration. Imam Shafiq is a university administrator in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
When you look at institutions, big institutions like the University of Dar es Salaam, like the University of Makerere, traditionally in this region it is the biggest almost, or Kenyatta University in Kenya, these other universities. With the advent of economic liberalization policies that were adopted from the World Bank by these governments of ours, these policies come from there in Washington and New York, you know that.
Right.
But specifically, but anyway, the things were not well studied. Now, it led to an influx of very many people into these institutions of higher learning. Very many students beyond manageable capacities.
But that is a good thing, right? That means many more people are accessing education.
Yes, it's okay. But the influx came at a time when the cost had not risen so much. Now that they are already there, people have no choice but to struggle and finish their courses. Then fees are being hiked even in advance of those who would be the first students coming in. But the hiking of fees does not commensurate the standards, you know, because these universities, something is becoming like every man for himself and God for us all.
Right.
I just give them marks after all. Are they my children? Let me marry to them as long as I get my salary. These things are happening. Because at the end of the day, it is the CEOs who are eating a lion's share of these school fees.
You mean the owners of the schools?
They are very exploitative. If they look at how they can establish other institutions, even beyond the borders, and they don't look at the workers well.
That's including the teachers.
Yes, this is the problem. Because my knowledge of education as a profession, not so.
Right.
My knowledge of it is that it survives largely on the word motivation. Now, without motivation, education is not there. And motivation is not only for teachers. It is also for the learners in class.
The students.
But a teacher will not motivate a student to learn when a teacher himself is not motivated.
So
this is the scenario.
Has the increase in cost of education led to a dropout, high dropout in universities like the one you're working in?
Yes, it is true, because I see many applicants for what we call dead years. Dead years here in Africa. I don't know the phenomenon of the West.
No.
But in Africa here, people ask for dead years, meaning that I was pursuing this course, but this year I'm not able to pay fees, or I'm sick, or all these other reasons. So I will not do exams. But usually, a larger component of it goes to the tuition fees aspect. For those who cannot afford it, they go down and go to work maybe to get money and come and do the same exams another year, you know, or they never come back at all. This is the scenario. It is a vicious cycle, you know. That is the problem, Jackson.
That was Imam Shafiq, a university administrator in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Thank you very much for listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. I would like to thank my co-host Nadia Sam in Johannesburg, South Africa. I would also like to thank all our listeners who contributed to the show this time around. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, my handle is at Upfront Africa. Let's connect again next week, right here, same time. My name is Jackson Vunganyi.